Chapter 47. Haute-Savoie, France. They gave him clothing to wear, and a dose of alprazolam to take the edge off his anxiety. He was permitted to sit in a proper chair with his hands unrestrained, though the chair was turned in such a way that he could not help but see his two dead employees, grim reminders of the fate that awaited him if he retreated once again into claims of ignorance. Within a few hours, the corpses would vanish from the face of the earth. Vladimir Chernoff would vanish with them. Whether he met his death painlessly or with extreme violence depended on one thing, answering each and every one of Gabriel's questions truthfully. The alprazolam had the added benefit of loosening Chernoff's tongue, and it took only the gentlest prodding from Gabriel to get him talking. He began by paying Gabriel a compliment over the operation they had staged on his doorstep.
"The KGB could not have done it any better," he said, without a trace of irony in his voice.
"You'll forgive me if I'm not flattered."
"You just killed two men in cold blood alone. You have no right to quibble about comparisons to my old service."
"You know my name." Chernoff managed a weak smile.
"Would it be possible to have a cigarette?"
"Cigarettes are bad for your health."
"Is it not a tradition to keep the condemned a cigarette?"
"Keep talking, Vladimir, and I'll let you live."
"After what I've seen tonight, do you take me for a fool, Alon?"
"Not a fool, Vladimir. Just an ex-KGB hood who somehow managed to claw his way out of the gutter. But let's keep this civil, shall we? You were just about to tell me when you first met the man in the photograph." A pause, then. "The man known as Comrade Zhirlov." The cocktail of narcotics coursing through Chernoff's bloodstream left him unable to mount another campaign of denial. Nor was he able to conceal his surprise over the fact that Gabriel knew the code name of one of the KGB's most secretive black operators.
"It was 95 or 96. I had a small security company. I didn't land the likes of Ivan Korkov and Viktor Orlov, but I was doing quite nicely for myself. Comrade Zhirlov approached me with a lucrative offer. He'd acquired a reputation in Moscow. It was getting much too dangerous for him to be in direct contact with his customers. He needed someone to act as a middleman, a booking agent, if you will. Otherwise, he wasn't going to live to enjoy the fruits of his labor.
And you volunteered to be that person. For a commission, of course."
10%. When someone needed a job done, they came to me, and I took the proposal to him. If he felt like doing it, he would name a price. Then I would go back to the client and negotiate the final deal. All money flowed through me. I laundered it through my consulting business and paid Comrade Zhirlov a fee for services rendered. You might find this hard to believe, but he actually paid taxes on income he earned killing and kidnapping people.
Only in Russia.
They were crazy times, Alon. It's easy to sit in judgment of us, but you've never seen your country and your money disappear in the blink of an eye. People did what they had to do in order to survive. It was the law of the jungle.
Truly. Spare me the sad story, Vladimir. It wouldn't have been a jungle if not for you and your fellow travelers in the Russian mafia. But I digress. You were telling me about Comrade Zhirlov. In fact, you were about to tell me his real name.
I'd like a cigarette. You're in no position to make demands.
Please, Alon. I had a pack in the pocket of my overcoat last night. If it wouldn't be too much trouble, I would like one now. I swear I won't try anything.
Gabriel glanced at Yakov. The cigarette, when it came, was already lit. Chernoff took a long pull, then told Gabriel the name he wanted to hear. It was Petrov. Anton Dmitrievich Petrov. Not that it mattered, Chernoff added quickly. Petrov hadn't used the name in years. The son of a KGB colonel assigned to the East Berlin Residentura. He had been born in the German Democratic Republic during the darkest days of the Cold War. An only child, he had been permitted to play with German children, and was completely bilingual at an early age. Indeed, Petrov's German was so good, he was able to pass himself off as a native on the streets of East Berlin. The KGB quietly encouraged Petrov's linguistic skills, by allowing him to remain in the DDR for his schooling, rather than return to the Soviet Union. After graduating with honors from a gymnasium in East Berlin, he attended the prestigious University of Leipzig, where he earned a degree in chemistry. Petrov briefly considered pursuing an advanced degree or even a career in medicine. Moscow Center, however, had other plans. Within days of graduation, he was summoned to Moscow and offered a job with the KGB. Few young men were foolish enough to refuse such an offer, and Petrov, a member of the KGB's extended family, entertained no such thoughts. After undergoing 2 years of training at the KGB's Red Banner Institute at Yasenyevo, he was given the codename Comrade Zhirov and sent back to East Berlin. A month later, with the help of a Soviet spy inside the West German intelligence service, he slipped through the Iron Curtain and established himself as an illegal agent in the West German city of Hamburg. Petrov's very existence was known only to a select group of senior generals inside the First Chief Directorate. His assignment was not to conduct espionage against America and its NATO allies, but to wage war on dissidents, defectors, and other assorted troublemakers who dared to challenge the authority of the Soviet state. Armed with a half dozen false passports and a limitless supply of money, he hunted his quarry and meticulously planned their demise. He specialized in the use of poisons and other deadly toxins, some that produced near instantaneous death, others that took weeks or months to prove lethal. Because he was a chemist, Petrov was able to assist in the design of his poisons and the weapons that delivered them. His favorite device was a ring worn on his right hand that injected the victim with a small dose of a deadly nerve toxin. One handshake, one clap on the back, was all it took to kill.
As you might expect, Petrov didn't take the fall of the Soviet Union well. He never had any qualms about killing dissidents and traitors. He was a believer.
What happened to all his KGB-issued passports?
He kept them. They came in handy when he moved to the West.
And you came with him?
Actually, I came first.
Petrov followed a month or two later, and our partnership resumed.
Business was brisk. Russians were pouring in Western Europe, and they brought the old ways with them. Within a few months, we had more clients than we could handle.
And one of these clients was Ivan Karkov. The Russian hesitated, then nodded his head.
Ivan trusted him. Their fathers were both KGB,
and they were both KGB. Did you deal with Ivan directly?
Never. Only with Arkady Medvedev.
And after Arkady was killed?
Ivan sent someone else, called himself Malinsky.
Do you remember the date?
It was sometime last October.
After Ivan's missile deal was made public?
Definitely after.
Did you meet in Geneva?
He was afraid I was being watched in Geneva. He insisted I come to Vienna.
He had a job offer?
Two jobs, actually. Serious jobs. Serious money.
The first was Grigory Boganov?
Correct.
And the second was me?
No, not you alone. The second job was your wife.
Chapter 48. Haute Savoie, France. Gabriel felt a wave of anger break over him. He wanted to drive his fist through the Russian's face. He wanted to hit him so hard he would never get up again. Instead, he sat calmly, Glock in his hand, dead men over his shoulder, and asked Chernov to describe the genesis of the operation to kidnap Grigory.
It was the challenge of a lifetime. At least, that's how Petrov viewed it. Ivan wanted Boganov taken from London and brought back to Russia. What's more, it had to look as if Boganov came home voluntarily. Otherwise, Ivan's backers in the Kremlin wouldn't give him the green light. They didn't want another battle with the British like the one that followed Litvinenko's poisoning.
How much?
20 million plus expenses, which were going to be substantial. Petrov had done jobs like this when he was still with the KGB. He assembled a team of experienced operatives and put together a plan. Everything hinged on getting Boganov into the car quietly. It couldn't be a muscle job, not with the CCTV cameras looking over his shoulder. So, he tricked Boganov's ex-wife into helping him.
Tell me about the people who work for him.
They're all ex-KGB. And like Petrov, they're all very good.
Who pays them?
Petrov takes care of them out of his cut. I hear he's very generous. He's never had any trouble with his employees.
Chernoff had smoked the cigarette to the filter. He drew a last lungful and looked for a place to put the butt. Lakov took it from Chernoff's fingers and tossed it into the fire. Gabriel refused a request for another cigarette and resumed the questioning. Someone took a wild shot at a Russian journalist the other night in Oxford.
You're referring to Olga Sokolova?
I am, and I don't suppose Petrov was there that night.
If he had been, Olga wouldn't have survived. It was a rush job. He sent a couple of associates to handle it for him.
What is Petrov?
He was in Italy preparing to kidnap your wife.
Gabriel felt another wave of anger. He suppressed it and posed his next question. How did he find us?
He didn't. The SVR did. They heard rumors you were in hiding in Italy and started leaning on their sources inside the Italian services. Eventually, one of them sold you out.
Do you know who?
Absolutely not.
Gabriel didn't make another run at him. He believed the Russian was telling the truth. What kind of information were you given about me?
Your name and the location of the estate where you were living.
Why did you wait so long to act?
Client's instructions. The operation against your wife would go forward only if Bogdanov's abduction went smoothly, and only if the client gave a final order to proceed.
When did you receive such an order?
A week after Bogdanov was taken.
Did it come from Alensky?
No. It was from the man himself. Ivan called my office in Geneva. In so many words, he made it clear Petrov was to move against the second target.
Chernoff paused.
I saw a photograph of your wife alone. She's a remarkably beautiful woman. I'm sorry we had to take her, but business is...
Gabriel struck Chernoff hard across the face with a Glock, reopening the gash over his eye.
Where's Petrov now?
I don't know.
Gabriel gazed at the fire.
Remember our agreement, Vladimir. You could peel the flesh from my bones alone and I wouldn't be able to tell you where he is. I don't know where he lives, and I don't know where he is at any given time.
How do you make contact with him?
I don't. He contacts me.
How?
Telephone. But don't think about trying to track him. He switches phones constantly and never keeps one for long.
What are your financial arrangements?
Same as the old days in Moscow. The client pays me, I pay him.
Do you launder it through Regency Security?
The Europeans are too sophisticated for that. Here, he's paid in cash.
Where do you deliver the money?
We share several numbered accounts in Switzerland. I leave the cash in safe deposit boxes, and he collects it when he feels like it.
When was the last time you filled a box? Chernoff lapsed into silence. Gabriel gazed into the fire and repeated the question.
I left 5 million euros in Zurich the day before yesterday.
What time?
Just before closing. I like to go when the bank is empty.
What's the name of the bank?
Becker and Poole.
Gabriel knew it. He also happened to know the address. He asked for it now just to make certain Chernoff wasn't lying. The Russian answered correctly. Becker and Poole was located at Talstrasse 26. Account number?
9-7-3-8-3-6-2-4.
Repeat it. Chernoff did. No mistakes. Password?
Bolzak.
How poetic.
It was Petrov's choice. He likes to read. I've never had time for it myself.
The Russian looked at the gun in Gabriel's hand.
I suppose I never will.
There was one final gunshot in the villa above Lake-on-Sea. Gabriel did not hear it. At the moment it was fired, he was seated next to Usinavot in the Renault station wagon, heading quickly down the valley through the gray light of morning. They stopped in Geneva long enough to collect Sarah Bancroft from the Hotel Bristol, then set out for Zurich. Chapter 49. The room in the cellar of the little dacha was not entirely cut off from the outside world. High in one corner was a tiny window, covered in a century of grime, and on the outside, by a snowbank. For a few moments each day, when the angle of the sun was just right, the snow would turn scarlet and fill the room with a faint light. They assumed it was sunrise, but could not be certain. Along with their freedom, Yvonne had robbed them of time. Kiara cherished each second of the light, even if it meant she had no choice but to gaze directly into Grigori's battered face. The cuts, the bruises, the disfiguring swelling. There were moments he scarcely looked human at all. She cared for him as best she could, and once, bravely, she asked Yvonne's guards for bandages and something for the pain. The guards found her request amusing. They had gone to a good deal of trouble getting Grigori into his present condition, and weren't about to let the new prisoner undo all their hard work with gauze and ointment. Their hands were cuffed at all times, their legs shackled. They were given no pillows or blankets, and even during the bitter cold of night, no heat. Twice each day they were given a bit of food, coarse bread, a few slices of fatty sausage, weak tea in paper cups, and twice each day they were taken to a darkened, fetid toilet. Nights were passed side by side on the cold concrete floor. On the first night, Kiara dreamed she was searching for a child in an endless birch forest covered in snow. Forcing herself to wake, she found Grigori trying gently to comfort her. The next night she was awakened by a rush of warm fluid between her legs. This time, nothing he did could console her. She had just lost Gabriel's child. Mindful of Yvonne's microphones, they spoke of nothing of consequence. Finally, during the brief period of light on their third day together, Grigori asked about the circumstances of Kiara's capture. She thought a moment before answering, then gave a carefully calibrated version of the truth. She told him she had been taken from a road in Italy, and that two young men, good boys with bright futures, had been killed trying to protect her. She failed to mention, however, that for 3 days prior to her capture, she had been in Lake Como participating in the interrogation of Grigori's former wife, Irina, or that she knew how Yvonne's operatives had deceived Irina into taking part in Grigori's capture, or that Gabriel's team had loved Irina so much that sending her back to Russia after the debriefing had broken their hearts. Kiara wanted to tell Grigori these things, but could not. Yvonne was listening. When it came time for Grigori to describe his ordeal, he made no such omissions. The story he told was the same one Kiara had heard in Lake Como a few days earlier, but from the other side of the looking glass. He had been on his way to a chess match against a man named Simon Finch, a devout Marxist who wanted to inflict Russia's suffering on the West. During a brief stop at the waterside cafe, he had noticed he was being followed by a man and a woman. He assumed they were watchers from MI5, and that it was safe to continue. His opinion changed a few moments later when he noticed another man, a Russian, shadowing him along Harrow Road. Then he saw a woman walking toward him, a woman who carried no umbrella and was hatless in the rain, and realized he had seen her a few minutes before. He feared he was about to be killed and briefly considered making a mad dash across Harrow Road. Then a Mercedes sedan had appeared, and its door had swung open. I recognized the man holding the gun to my former wife's head. His name is Petrov. Most people who encountered this man do not survive. I was told Irina would be an exception if I cooperated. I did everything they asked. But a few days into my captivity, while I was being interrogated in the cellars of Lubyanka, a man who had once been my friend told me Irina was dead. He said Yvonne had killed her and buried her in an unmarked grave. He said I was next. Just then the color retreated from the snowbank over the window, and the room was plunged once more into darkness. Kiara wept silently. She wanted desperately to tell Grigori his wife was still alive. She could not. Yvonne was listening. Chapter 50. Zurich. Later, Shamron would refer to Conrad Becker as Gabriel's one and only bit of good luck. Everything else Gabriel earned the hard way, or with blood. But not Becker. Becker was delivered to him gift-wrapped and tied with a bow. His bank was not one of the cathedrals of Swiss finance that loom over the Paradeplatz or line the graceful curve of the Bahnhofstrasse. It was a private chapel, a place where clients were free to worship or confess their sins in secret. Swiss law forbids such banks from soliciting deposits. They are free to refer to themselves as banks if they wish, but are not required to do so. Some employ several dozen officers and investment specialists, others only a handful. Becker and Poole fell into the second category. It was located on the ground floor of a leaden old office building on a quiet block of the Talstrasse. The entrance was marked only by a small brass plaque and was easy to miss, which was Conrad Becker's intention. He was waiting in the gloomy vestibule at 7 a.m., a small, bald figure with the pallor of one who spends his days beneath ground. As usual, he was wearing a somber dark suit and a pallbearer's gray tie. His eyes, sensitive to light, were concealed behind a pair of tinted glasses. The brevity of the handshake was a calculated insult.
"That's an unpleasant surprise. What brings you to Zurich, Herr Alon?"
"Business."
"Well, you've come to the right place."
He turned without another word and led Gabriel down a thickly carpeted passage. The office they entered was of modest size and poorly lit. Becker walked slowly around his desk and settled himself tentatively in the executive leather chair, as though trying it out for the first time. He regarded Gabriel nervously for a moment, then started turning over the papers on his desk.
"I was assured by Herr Chameron that there would be no further contact between us. I fulfilled my end of our agreement, and I expect you to honor your word."
"I need your help, Conrad."
"And what sort of help do you require from me, Herr Alon? Would you like me to assist in a raid against Hamas targets in the Gaza Strip? Or perhaps you would like me to help you destroy the nuclear facilities in Iran?"
"Don't be melodramatic."
"Who's being melodramatic? I'm lucky to be alive."
Becker folded his tiny hands and placed them carefully on the desk.
"I am a man of weak physical and emotional constitution, Herr Alon. I am not ashamed to admit it. Nor am I ashamed to say that I still have nightmares about our last little adventure together in Vienna."
For the first time since Chiara's abduction, Gabriel was tempted to smile. Even he had trouble believing the little Swiss banker had played an operational role in one of the greatest coups the office had ever engineered, the capture of Nazi war criminal Erich Radek. Technically, Becker's actions had been a violation of Switzerland's sacrosanct banking secrecy laws. Indeed, if his role in Radek's capture ever became public, he faced the distinct possibility of prosecution, or even worse, financial ruin. All of which explained why Gabriel was confident that Becker, after a predictable protest, would agree to help. He had no choice. "It has come to our attention you are the holder of a numbered account that is of interest to us. A safe deposit box associated with this account is linked to a matter of extreme urgency. It is not an exaggeration to say it is a matter of life and death."
"As you know, it would be a crime under Swiss banking law for me to reveal that information to you."
Gabriel sighed heavily.
"Ah, it would be a shame, Conrad." "What's that, Herr Alon? If our past work together ever became public?"
"You are a cheap extortionist, Herr Alon."
"An extortionist, but not cheap."
"And the trouble with paying money to an extortionist is that he always comes back for more."
"Can I give you the account number, Conrad?"
"If you must."
Gabriel recited it rapidly. Becker didn't bother to write it down.
"Password?"
he asked. "Balzac." "And the name associated with the account?"
"Vladimir Chernov of Regency Security Services, Geneva. We're not sure if he's the primary account holder or merely a signatory."
The banker made no movement. "Don't you need to go check your records, Conrad?" He didn't.
"Vladimir Chernov is the primary name on the account. One other person has access to the safe deposit box."
Gabriel held up the photograph of Anton Petrov.
"This man?"
Becker nodded. "If he has access, I assume you have a name on file."
"I have a name. Whether it is accurate..."
"May I have it, please?"
"He calls himself Wolf, Otto Wolf."
"German speaker?"
"Fluent."
"Accent?"
"He doesn't talk a great deal, but I'd say he came originally from the East."
"Do you have an address and telephone number on file?"
"I do, but I don't believe they're accurate either."
"But you give him access to a safe deposit box anyway?" Becker made no response. Gabriel put away the photo. "It is my understanding Vladimir Chernov left something in the box 2 days ago."
"To be precise, Herr Chernov accessed the box 2 days ago. Whether he added something or removed something, I cannot say. Clients are given complete privacy when in the vault room."
Except when you're watching them with your concealed cameras. He left cash in the box, didn't he?
A great deal of cash, actually.
Has Wolf collected it?
Not yet.
Gabriel's heart gave a sideways lurch. How long does he usually wait after Chernoff fills the box?
I would expect him today. Tomorrow at the latest. He's not the kind of man to leave money sitting around.
I'd like to see the vault room.
I'm afraid that's not possible.
Conrad, please. We don't have much time. The outer door was stainless steel and had a circular latch the size of a captain's wheel. Inside was a second door, also stainless steel, with a small window of reinforced glass. The outer door was closed only at night, explained Becker, while the interior door was used during business hours. Tell me the procedures when a customer wants access to a box.
After being admitted through the front door on the Tallstrasse, the client checks in with the receptionist. The receptionist then sends the client to my secretary. I'm the only one who deals with numbered accounts. The client must provide two pieces of information.
The number and the corresponding password. Becker nodded his bald head.
In most cases, it's a formality, since I know virtually all our clients on site. I make an entry in the logbook, then escort the client into the vault room. It takes two keys to open the box, mine and the client's. Generally, I remove the box and place it on the table, at which point I depart.
Closing the door behind you?
Of course.
And locking it?
Absolutely.
Do you and the client enter the vault alone?
Never. I'm always accompanied by our security guard.
Does the guard leave the room, too?
Yes.
What happens when the client is ready to depart?
He summons the guard by pressing the buzzer.
Is there any other way out of the bank besides the Tallstrasse?
There's a service door leading to a back alleyway and parking spaces. He shares them with the other tenants in the building. They're all assigned.
Gabriel looked around at the gleaming stainless steel boxes, then at Becker. The tinted lenses of his spectacles shone with the reflection of the bright fluorescent lights, rendering his small dark eyes invisible. I'm going to need a favor from you, Conrad. A very big favor.
Since I would like to keep my bank, Herrelon, how can I help?
Call your security guard and your secretary. Tell them to take the next couple of days off.
I assume you are going to replace them.
I wouldn't want to leave you in a lurch, Conrad.
Anyone I know?
The secretary will be new to. But you may recall the security guard from another life.
Helen, I take it?
You do have a good memory, Conrad.
That's true. But then, a man like Oscar Lange is not so easy to forget.
Chapter 51. Zurich. Gabriel left the bank shortly after 8 and walked to a busy cafe on the Bahnhofstrasse. Seated at a cramped table in the back, surrounded by depressed-looking Swiss moneymen, was Sarah and Uzi Navot. Sarah was drinking coffee. Navot was working his way through a plate of scrambled eggs and toast. The smell of the food turned Gabriel's stomach as he lowered himself into an empty chair. It was going to be a long time before he felt like eating again. The maids arrived an hour after we left, Navot murmured in Hebrew. The bodies have been removed, and they are giving the entire house a good scrubbing. Tell them to make sure those bodies never turn up. I don't want Ivan to know Chernoff has been taken out of circulation. Ivan won't know a thing, and neither will Petrov. Navot put a forkful of eggs on his toast and switched from Hebrew to German, which he spoke with a slight Viennese accent. How's my old friend Herr Becker? He sends his best. Is he willing to help?
Willing might be too strong a word, but we're in.
In rapid German, Gabriel described the procedures for client access to safe deposit boxes at Becker and Poole. The briefing complete, he signaled the waiter and asked for coffee. Then he requested that Navot's dishes be removed. Navot snatched a last morsel of toast as the plate floated away. Which girl gets the secretary job? She has to speak English, German, and French. That leaves only one candidate. Navot looked briefly at Sarah.
I'd feel better about getting Langley's approval before sending her in there.
Carter gave me the authority to use her in whatever capacity I needed. Besides, I used her in an operational role last night in Geneva.
And all she had to do was play the jilted lover for a few seconds.
Now you're talking about placing her in close proximity to a former KGB assassin. Sarah spoke for the first time.
I can handle it, Uzi.
You're forgetting that Ivan has pictures of you from his house in Saint-Tropez last summer. And it's possible he's shown those pictures to his friend Petrov. I packed a dark wig and fake glasses. When I put them on, I barely recognize myself. And no one else will either, especially if they've never met me in person.
Navot was still skeptical.
There is one other thing to consider, Gabriel.
What's that?
Her weapons training. More to the point, her lack of weapons training.
I trained her.
So did the agency.
No, you gave her very basic training, and the agency prepared her for a desk job in the counterterrorism center. There's not a lot of gunfire on a typical day at Langley.
Sarah spoke up in her own defense.
I can handle a gun, Uzi.
Not like Dina and Ramona. They both served in the army, and if something goes wrong in there...
They won't hesitate?
Navot made no response.
I won't hesitate either, Uzi.
You sure about that?
I'm sure.
The waiter delivered Gabriel's coffee. Navot handed him a packet of sugar.
I suppose the secretary job is now filled.
It is.
Who do you have in mind for the security guard?
The language requirements are the same, English, French, and German. He also needs a bit of muscle.
That narrows the field considerably. You and me. And since there's no doubt whatsoever that Petrov knows your face, it means you can't go anywhere near that bank.
If you don't, I'll do it, Navot said quickly. I'll take care of it.
You're the strongest person I know, Uzi.
Not strong enough to stop Russian poison.
Just don't shake hands with him.
And remember, you won't be alone. The instant you let Petrov into the vault, Sarah will signal us and wheel into the bank. When you open the door again to let Petrov out, he'll be confronted by several men.
Where do we take him?
Out the back door and into the van. We'll hit him with a little something to keep him comfortable during the drive.
Navot made a show of examining his clothing. Like Gabriel, he was wearing a sweater and a leather coat.
I need something a little more presentable.
He ran his hand over his chin.
I could also use a shave.
You can go shopping here on the Bahnhofstrasse.
But hurry, Uzi. I wouldn't want you to be late for your first day of work.
The old hands like to say that the life of an office field agent is one of constant travel and mind-numbing boredom, broken by interludes of sheer terror. And then there is the waiting. Waiting for a plane or a train. Waiting for a source. Waiting for the sun to rise after a night of killing. And waiting for a Russian assassin to collect $5 million from a safe deposit box in Zurich. For Gabriel, the waiting was made worse by the images that flashed through his thoughts like paintings in a gallery. The images robbed him of his natural patience. They made him restless. They made him terrified. And they stripped him of the emotional coldness that Chamron had found so appealing when Gabriel was a boy of 22.
Don't hate them,
Chamron had said of the Black September terrorists.
Just kill them so they can't kill again.
Gabriel had obeyed. He tried to obey now, but could not. He hated Ivan. He hated Ivan as he had never hated before. The interminable day of watching was not without its lighter moments. They were supplied almost exclusively by the pair of transmitters in the boat planted inside Becker and Poole, within minutes of his arrival. The team listened while Miss Irene Moore, an attractive young American sent by a Zurich temp agency, fetched Herr Becker's coffee, and took Herr Becker's dictation, and answered Herr Becker's telephone, and accepted Herr Becker's many compliments about her appearance, and deftly declined an invitation to dine with Herr Becker at a restaurant overlooking the Zurich Stay. And they listened, too, while Herr Becker and Oscar Lange spent several uncomfortable moments getting reacquainted. And while Herr Becker instructed Herr Lange on the intricacies of opening and closing a vault. And in late afternoon, they heard Herr Becker berating Herr Lange for failing to open the vault quickly enough when Mr. Al-Hamdali of Jeddah wanted access to a safe deposit box. Unwilling to let a good opportunity go to waste, they instructed Miss Moore to copy the contents of Mr. Al-Hamdali's file. Then, for good measure, they snapped several photographs of the same Mr. Al-Hamdali as he exited the bank. 30 minutes later, Becker and Poole drew its shades and switched off its lights. The security guard and secretary bade Herr Becker goodnight and went their separate ways. Herr Lange heading left toward the Badengasse, Miss Moore right toward the Bleicherweg. Gabriel, who was with Levon in a parked car, didn't bother to hide his disappointment.
"We'll come back tomorrow,"
Levon said,
doing his best to console him.
And the day after, if we have to.
But Levon, like Gabriel, knew that time was limited. Yvonne had given them just 72 hours. It was time enough for just one more day in Zurich. Gabriel instructed the team to return to their hotel rooms and rest. Though desperately in need of sleep himself, he neglected to heed his own advice, and instead slipped quietly into the back of a surveillance van parked along the Paulstrasse. There he spent the night alone, his gaze fixed on the entrance of Becker and Poole, waiting for Yvonne's assassin. Yvonne's brother from the KGB, Yvonne's old friend from Moscow in the 90s. The bad old days when there was no law and nothing to prevent Yvonne from killing his way to the top. A man like that might know where Yvonne liked to do his blood work. Who knows? A man like that might have killed there himself. A few minutes before 9 the next morning, Sarah and Levant arrived for work. Wilsey relieved Gabriel in the van, and it all started again. The watching. The waiting. Always the waiting. Shortly after 4 that afternoon, Gabriel found himself paired with Mikhail in a cafe overlooking the Paradeplatz. Mikhail ordered Gabriel something to eat.
"And don't try to sing or you look like hell. Besides, you're going to need your strength when you take down Petrov. I'm starting to think he's not going to come.
And leave 5 million euros on the table.
He'll come, Gabriel. Eventually he'll come."
"What makes you so sure?"
"Chernov came at the end of the day, and Petrov will come at the end of the day. These Russian thugs don't do anything when it's light out. They prefer the night. Trust me, Gabriel, I know them better than you. I grew up with these bastards."
They were seated side by side along a high counter in the window. Outside, street lamps were coming on in the busy square, and the trams were snaking up and down the Bahnhofstrasse. Mikhail was drumming his fingers nervously.
"You're giving me a headache, Mikhail."
"Sorry, boss."
The fingers went still.
"Something bothering you?"
"Other than the fact we're waiting for a Russian killer to collect the proceeds for kidnapping your wife? No, Gabriel, nothing's bothering me at all."
"Do you disagree with my decision to send Sarah into that bank?"
"Of course not, she's perfect for the job."
"Because if you disagreed with one of my decisions, you would tell me, wouldn't you, Mikhail?
That's always been the way the team works. We talk about everything."
"I would have said something if I disagreed."
"Good, Mikhail.
Because I would hate to think something has changed because you're involved with Sarah."
Mikhail sipped his coffee, a play for time.
"Listen, Gabriel, I was going to say something, but..."
"But what?"
"I thought you'd be angry."
"Why?"
"Come on, Gabriel, don't make me say this now. It's not the time.
It's the perfect time."
Mikhail placed his coffee on the counter.
"It was obvious to all of us from the minute we recruited Sarah for the Al-Bakari operation that she has feelings for you.
And frankly..."
"Frankly what?" "We thought you might have felt the same way."
"That's not true.
It's never been true."
"Okay, Gabriel.
Whatever you say."
A waitress placed a sandwich in front of Gabriel. He immediately pushed it aside.
"Eat it, Gabriel. You have to eat."
Gabriel tore a corner from the sandwich.
"Are you in love with her, Mikhail?"
"What answer do you want to hear?"
"The truth would be nice."
"Yes, Gabriel.
I love her very much.
Too much.
There's no such thing.
Just do me a favor, Mikhail. Take good care of her.
Go live in America. Get out of this business as soon as you can. Get out before..."
He left the thought unfinished. Mikhail began drumming his fingers again.
"Do you think he'll come?"
"He'll come."
"2 days of waiting. I can't stand the waiting anymore."
"You won't have to wait much longer, Mikhail."
"How can you be so certain?"
"Because Anton Petrov just walked past us."
Chapter 52. Zurich. He wore a dark toggle coat, a gray scarf, large wire-framed glasses, and a flat cap pulled low. Oddly enough, the crude disguise threw the advantage over to Gabriel. He had spent countless hours staring at the surveillance photographs from Heathrow Airport, the fragmentary glimpses of a sturdy-jawed man wearing glasses and a fedora. It was this man who walked past the cafe overlooking the Paradeplatz, carrying a pair of mismatched attaché cases. And it was this man who was now rounding the corner into the Paulstrasse. Gabriel raised his wrist mic carefully to his lips and informed Sarah and Navot that Petrov was headed their way. By the time the transmission was complete, Mikhail was on his feet, moving toward the door. Gabriel left a wad of money on the table and followed him.
"You forgot to pay the bill," he said. "The Swiss get very angry when you run out on a check."
Petrov walked past the bank twice before finally presenting himself at the entrance just 3 minutes before closing. Pressing the buzzer, he identified himself as Herr Otto Wolf and was admitted without delay. The receptionist immediately telephoned Miss Irene Moore, Herr Becker's temporary secretary, and was instructed to send the client back straight away. Outside, on the Talstrasse, two pairs of men moved quietly into place, Yakov and Oded at one end, Gabriel and Mikhail at the other. Mikhail was calmly humming to himself. Gabriel didn't hear it. He was focused only on the voice in his ear, the voice of Sarah Bancroft, bidding a pleasant evening to one of the world's most dangerous men.
"Why don't you have a seat, Herr Wolf?"
she said in perfect German.
"Herr Becker will be with you in just a moment."
He placed the attaché cases on the floor next to the chair, unbuttoned his coat, and removed his leather gloves. The fingers of the left hand were absent any rings. On the third finger of the right hand, the one where an ordinary Russian would have worn a wedding band, was a heavy ring with a dark stone. In America, it would have been mistaken for a class ring or the ring of a military unit. Sarah, seated at her desk, forced herself not to look at it.
"May I take your coat?"
"No."
"Something to drink? Coffee or tea?"
He shook his head and sat without removing his overcoat or hat.
"You're not Herr Becker's usual secretary."
"She's sick."
"Nothing serious, I hope."
"Just a virus."
"There's a lot going around." "I've never seen you here before."
"I'm a temp."
"You're not Swiss."
"American, actually."
"Your German is very good. It even has a bit of a Swiss accent."
"I went to school here for a few years when I was young."
"Which one?"
Sarah's answer was interrupted by the appearance of Becker in the door of his office. Petrov stood.
"Your secretary was just telling me the name of the school she attended in Switzerland."
"It was the International School of Geneva."
"It has an excellent reputation."
He extended his right hand.
"It was a pleasure to meet you, Miss..." His voice trailed off.
"Moore."
Sarah grasped the hand firmly.
"Irene Moore."
Petrov released Sarah's hand and entered Becker's office. 30 seconds later, the formalities complete, the two men emerged and set off together toward the vault room. Sarah passed that information to Gabriel over the microphone concealed on her desk, then reached beneath the desk and unzipped her handbag. The gun was there, barrel pointed downward, grip exposed. She glanced at the clock and waited for the sound of the front buzzer. Her hand was beginning to itch on the spot where Petrov's ring had touched her. It was nothing, she told herself. Just her mind playing tricks. Uzina Bolt was waiting outside the entrance to the vault room when Becker appeared, followed by Anton Petrov. The Heathrow surveillance photos had not done justice to the Russian's size. He was well over 6 feet, broad-shouldered and well-built. He was also clearly uneasy. Staring directly at Navot, he asked of Becker,
"Where's the usual security guard?"
The banker answered without hesitation,
"We had to fire him. I'm afraid I can't go into the details. You may rest assured that no client assets were involved, including yours."
"I'm relieved."
His eyes were still on Navot.
"Quite a coincidence, though. A new secretary and a new guard."
Again, Becker managed a swift response.
"I'm afraid the only constant is change, even in Switzerland."
Navot opened the secondary door to the vault room and stepped aside. The Russian remained frozen in place, his gaze flickering back and forth between the banker and the security guard. Petrov was obviously suspicious and reluctant to enter. Navot wondered whether 5 million euros in cash might be enough to tempt him. He didn't have to wait long for the answer.
"I'm sorry to trouble you, Herr Becker, but I've changed my mind. I'll see to my business another time."
Becker seemed taken aback. For an instant, Navot feared he might improvise and ask the Russian to reconsider his decision. Instead, he stepped aside with the curtness of a head waiter and gestured toward the exit.
"As you wish."
Petrov fixed Navot with a cautionary stare, then turned and started down the corridor. Navot quickly considered his options. If the Russian managed to make it out of the bank, the team would be left with two choices. Snatch him off a busy Zurich street, hardly optimal, or follow him to his next destination. Better to take him here, inside the premises of Becker and Poole, even if it meant doing it alone. Navot had one brief advantage, the fact Petrov's back was turned, and he took it. Moving Becker aside with one sweep of his left hand, he delivered a knife-like strike to the Russian's neck with his right. The blow might have killed a normal man, but Petrov merely stumbled. Regaining his balance, he quickly released the two attaché cases and reached beneath his coat with his left hand. As he turned to face Navot, the gun was already on its way out. Navot grabbed the Russian's left wrist and slammed it hard to the wall. Then he turned his head and frantically searched for the right hand. It wasn't hard to find. Fingers splayed, killing ring exposed. It was reaching for Navot's neck. Navot grabbed another wrist and held on. "You won't be alone," Gabriel had said. Funny how things never seem to go according to plan. Sarah heard two noises in rapid succession, a man grunting in pain, followed by a heavy thump. Then a few seconds later, she heard a third sound, the intercom buzzer. Gabriel and the others were waiting outside the entrance of the bank. It would take at least 30 seconds for them to be admitted and make their way to the vault room. 30 seconds that Uzi would be fighting for his life alone with a professional Russian assassin.
"I won't hesitate either, Uzi."
"You're sure about that?"
"I'm sure."
Sarah reached beneath her desk and drew the gun from her handbag. Chambering the first round, she got to her feet and headed into the corridor. On the third ring, the receptionist finally answered.
"May I help you?"
"My name is Heinrich Kiva. Herr Becker is expecting me."
"One moment, please."
The moment seems to last an eternity.
"Herr Kiva?"
"Yes?"
"I'm afraid no one is answering Herr Becker's line. Could you wait another moment, please?"
"Would it be possible for us to wait inside? It's a bit chilly out here."
"I'm afraid it's against policy. I'm sure Herr Becker will be with you in a moment."
"Thank you." Gabriel glanced at Mikhail. "I think we might have a problem in there."
"What do we do?"
"Unless you can think of some way to break into a Zurich bank. We wait." No amount of firearms training could possibly have prepared Sarah for the sight that greeted her as she entered the corridor leading to the vault room. One Swiss banker huddled in fear. Two large men trying very hard to kill each other. Navot had managed to pin Petrov to the wall and was struggling to control the Russian's arms. In Petrov's left hand was a gun. His right was empty, but the fingers were spread wide, and he appeared to be trying to grab Navot's neck.
The ring.
One touch of the stylus was all it would take. One touch, and Navot would be dead within minutes. Gun in her outstretched hands, Sarah sidestepped Becker and moved toward the two struggling men. Petrov immediately took note of her approach and attempted to aim his own weapon in her direction. Navot reacted quickly, twisting the Russian's arm and slamming it to the wall so the barrel was pointed toward the ceiling.
"Shoot him, Sarah! Shoot him, damn it!"
Sarah took two steps forward and pressed the gun against Petrov's left hip.
"I won't hesitate either, Uzi."
She didn't. Not for an instant. The round shattered the Russian's hip joint and caused his leg to buckle. Somehow the left hand managed to maintain its grip on the gun. The right was still inching toward Navot's neck.
"Again, Sarah! Shoot him again!"
This time she placed the gun against Petrov's left shoulder and pulled the trigger. As the Russian's arm went limp, she quickly tore the gun from his grasp. Free to use his own right hand, Navot balled it into a massive fist and gave Petrov three sledgehammer blows to the face. The final two were unnecessary. The Russian was out on his feet after the first. Chapter 53. Bargen, Switzerland. 3 miles from the German border, at the end of a narrow logging valley, stands Little Bargen, famous in Switzerland because it is the country's northernmost town. It has little to offer, other than a gas station and a small market, frequented by travelers on their way somewhere else. No one seemed to take note of the two men waiting outside in the parking lot in an Audi sedan. One had thinning, flyaway hair and was drinking coffee from a paper cup. The other had eyes of emerald and was watching the traffic speeding along the motorway, white lights headed towards Zurich, red lights streaming toward the German border. The waiting. Always the waiting. Waiting for a plane or a train. Waiting for a source. Waiting for the sun to rise after a night of killing. And waiting for a van carrying a wounded Russian assassin.
There's going to be hell to pay at that bank, said Ellie Levon.
Becca will keep it quiet. He has no choice. And if he can't, then we'll clean up the mess later. Good thing the Swiss joined the modern world and took down their border posts.
Remember the old days, Gabriel. They would get us coming and going.
I remember, Ellie.
I can't tell you how many times I had to sit there while those smug Swiss boys searched my trunk. Now they barely look at you. This will be our fourth Russian in 3 days, and no one will be the wiser.
We're doing them a favor.
If we keep going at this rate, there won't be any Russians left in Switzerland.
My point exactly. Just then, a van turned into the lot. Gabriel climbed out of the Audi and walked over. Pulling open the rear door, he saw Sarah and Nabot sitting on the floor of the cargo hold. Petrov was stretched between them.
How is he?
Still unconscious.
Pulse? Okay.
How's the blood loss?
Not too bad. I think the rounds cauterized the vessels.
King Saul Boulevard is sending a doctor to the interrogation site. Can he make it?
He'll be fine.
Nabot handed Gabriel a small Ziploc plastic bag.
He has a souvenir.
Inside was Petrov's ring. Gabriel carefully slipped the bag into his coat pocket and gestured for Sarah to get out of the van. He helped her into the back seat of the Audi, then climbed behind the wheel. 5 minutes later, both vehicles were safely over the invisible border and heading north into Germany. Sarah managed to keep her emotions in check for a few minutes longer. Then she leaned her head against the window and began to weep.
You did the right thing, Sarah. You saved Uzi's life.
I've never shot anyone before.
Really?
Don't make jokes, Gabriel. I don't feel so well.
You will.
When?
Eventually.
I think I'm going to be sick.
Shall I pull over?
No, keep going.
Are you sure?
I don't know.
I'll stop just in case.
Maybe you should.
Gabriel pulled to the side of the motorway and crouched at Sarah's side as her body retched.
I did it for you, Gabriel.
I know, Sarah.
I did it for Chiara.
I know.
How long am I going to feel this way?
Not long.
How long, Gabriel?
He rubbed Sarah's back as her body convulsed again.
Not long, he thought. Only forever.
Part 4. Resurrection Gate. Chapter 54. Northern Germany. For every safe house, there is a story. A salesman who lives out of a suitcase and rarely sees home. A couple with too much money to be tied to one place for long. An adventurous soul who travels to faraway lands to take pictures and scale mountains. These are the tales told to neighbors and landlords. These are the lies that explain short-term tenants and guests who arrive in the middle of the night with keys in their pockets. The villa near the Danish border had a story too, though some of it happened to be true. Before the Second World War, it had been owned by a family called Rosenthal. All but one member, a young girl, perished in the Holocaust, and after immigrating to Israel in the mid-1950s, she bequeathed her family home to the office. Known as Site 22XB, the property was the jewel in housekeeping's crown, reserved for only the most sensitive and important operations. Gabriel believed a Russian assassin with two bullet wounds and a head filled with vital secrets certainly fell into that category. Housekeeping had agreed. They had given him the keys and made certain the pantry was well provisioned. The house stood 100 yards from a quiet farm road, a lonely outpost on the stark, flat plain of western Uhlan. Time had taken its toll. The stucco needed a good scrubbing, the shutters were broken and peeling for want of paint, and the roof leaked when the big storms swept in from the North Sea. Inside was a similar story. Dust and cobwebs, rooms not quite furnished, fixtures and appliances from a bygone era. Indeed, to wander the halls was to step back in time, especially for Gabriel and Ellie Levon. Known to office veterans as Chateau Chameron, the house had served as a planning base during Operation Wrath of God. Men had been condemned to death here. Fates had been sealed. On the second floor was the room Levon and Gabriel had shared. Now, as then, it contained nothing but a pair of narrow beds separated by a chipped nightstand. As Gabriel stood in the doorway, an image flashed in his memory. The Watcher and the Executioner, lying awake in the darkness, one made sleepless by stress, the other by visions of blood. The ancient transistor radio that had filled the empty hours still stood on the table. It had been their link to the outside world. It had told them about wars won and lost, about an American president who resigned in disgrace. And sometimes, on summer nights, it played music for them. The music normal boys were listening to. Boys who weren't killing terrorists for Ari Shamron. Gabriel tossed his bag onto his old bed, the one nearest the window, and headed downstairs to the cellar. Anton Petrov lay supine across a bare stone floor, Nabot, Yakov, and Mikhail standing over him. His hands and feet were secured, though at this point it was scarcely necessary. Petrov's skin was ghostly white, his forehead damp with perspiration, his jaw distorted from swelling at the spot where Nabot had hit him. The Russian was in desperate need of medical attention. He would get it, only if he talked. If not, Gabriel would allow the rounds still lodged in his pelvis and shoulder to poison his body with sepsis. The death would be slow, feverish, and agonizing. It was the death he deserved, and Gabriel was more than prepared to grant it. He crouched at the Russian's side and spoke to him in German. "I believe this is yours." He reached into his coat pocket and removed the plastic bag Nabot had given him at the Swiss border. Petrov's ring was still inside. Gabriel removed it and pressed firmly on the stone. From the base emerged a small stylus, not much larger than a phonograph needle. Gabriel made a show of examining it, then moved it suddenly toward Petrov's face. The Russian recoiled in fear, twisting his head violently to the right. "What's wrong, Anton?" "It's just a ring." Gabriel inched it closer to the soft skin of Petrov's neck. The Russian was now writhing in terror. Gabriel pressed the stone again, and the needle retreated safely into the base of the ring. He slipped it back into the plastic bag and handed it carefully to Nabot. "In the interest of full disclosure, we worked on a similar device. But to be honest with you, I've never really cared for poisons. They're for cheap hoods like you, Anton. I've always preferred to do my killing with one of these." Gabriel removed the .45 caliber Glock from the waistband of his trousers and pointed it at Petrov's face. The suppressor was no longer screwed into the end of the barrel. It wasn't necessary here. "1 meter, Anton. That's how I prefer to kill. 1 meter. That way I can see my enemy's eyes before he dies. The Shayamira, the highest measure of punishment." Gabriel pressed the barrel of the gun against the base of the Russian's chin. "A grave without a marker. A corpse without a face." Gabriel used the barrel of the gun to open the front of Petrov's shirt. The shoulder wound didn't look good. Bone fragments, threads of clothing. No doubt the hip was just as bad. Gabriel closed the shirt and looked directly into Petrov's eyes. "You're here because your friend Vladimir Chernov betrayed you. We didn't have to hurt him. In fact, we didn't even have to threaten him. We just gave him a bit of money, and he told us everything we needed to know. Now it's your turn, Anton. If you cooperate, you will be given medical attention and treated humanely. If not..." Gabriel placed the barrel against Petrov's shoulder and corkscrewed it into the wound. Petrov's screams echoed off the stone walls of the cellar. Gabriel stopped before the Russian could pass out. "Do you understand, Anton?" The Russian nodded. "If I stay in your presence much longer, I'm going to beat you to death with my bare hands." He glanced at Nabot. "I'm going to let my friend handle the questioning. Since you tried to kill him with your ring back in Zurich, it only seems fair, wouldn't you agree, Anton?" The Russian was silent. Gabriel stood and headed upstairs without another word. The rest of the team was sprawled in the sitting room in various states of exhaustion. Gabriel's gaze immediately settled on the newest member of the group, doctor who had been dispatched by Kingsall Boulevard to treat Petrov's injuries. In the lexicon of the office, he was a scion, a volunteer helper. Gabriel recognized him. He was a Jew from Paris who had once treated Gabriel for a severe gash to his hand. "As the patient?" the doctor asked in French. "He's not a patient," Gabriel responded in the same language. "He's a KGB hood." "He's still a human being?" "I withhold judgment until you have a chance to meet him." "When will that be?" "I'm not sure." "Tell me about the wounds." Gabriel did. When were they inflicted? Gabriel glanced at his watch. Nearly 8 hours ago. Those bullets need to come out. Otherwise, they come out when I say they come out. I swear an oath, monsieur. I will not forsake that oath because I am performing a service for you. I swore an oath too, and tonight my oath trumps yours. Gabriel turned and went upstairs to his room. He stretched out on the bed, but each time he closed his eyes he saw only blood. Unable to drive the image from his thoughts, he reached out and turned the familiar dial of the radio. A German woman with a sultry voice bade him a good evening and began reading the news. The Chancellor was proposing a new era of dialogue and cooperation between Europe and Russia. She planned to unveil her proposal at the upcoming emergency G8 summit in Moscow. Like a night fever, Petrov broke at dawn. He did not walk a straight line during his journey to the truth, but then Gabriel had not expected he would. Petrov was a professional. He led them into cul-de-sac of illusion and down dead-end roads of deception. And though he had worked only for money, he tried admirably to keep faith with Russia and his patron saint, Ivan Kharkov. Nevot had been patient but firm. It was not necessary to inflict additional pain or even threaten it. Petrov was in enough pain already. All they had to do was keep him conscious. The two bullet wounds and broken jaw did the rest. Finally, exhausted and shaking from the onset of infection, the Russian capitulated. He said there was a dacha northeast of Moscow, in Vladimirskaya Oblast. It was isolated, hidden, protected. There were four streams converging into a great marsh. There was a vast birch forest. It was the place where Ivan did his blood work. It was Ivan's prison, Ivan's hell on earth. Nabot located the parceled land using ordinary commercial-grade software. The image on his screen matched Petrov's description perfectly. He sent for the doctor and headed upstairs to brief Gabriel. He was lying in darkness, fingers interlaced at the back of his neck, ankles crossed. Hearing the news, he sat up and swung his feet to the floor. Then he used his secure PDA to send a secure flash transmission to three points around the globe: Kingsall Boulevard, Thames House, and Langley. An hour after sunrise, he set out alone for Hamburg. At 2 p.m., he boarded British Airways Flight 969, and by 3:15 he was seated in the back of an MI5 sedan, heading toward the center of London. Chapter 55. Mayfair, London. In the dark days after the attacks of 9/11, the American Embassy at Grosvenor Square was transformed into a high-security eyesore. Almost overnight, barricades and blast walls sprouted along the perimeter, and much to the ire of Londoners, a busy street along one side of the embassy was permanently closed to traffic. But there were other changes the public could not see, including the construction of a secret CIA annex far beneath the square itself. Linked to the Global Ops Center in Langley, the annex served as a forward command post for operations in Europe and the Middle East, and was so secret only a handful of British ministers and intelligence officials knew of its existence. During a visit the previous summer, Graham Seymour had been depressed to find it dwarfed the primary ops room of both MI5 and MI6. It was typical of the Americans, he thought. Confronted by the threat of Islamic terrorism, they had dug a deep hole for themselves and filled it with high-tech toys. And they wondered why they were losing. Seymour arrived shortly after 8 that evening and was escorted to the fishbowl, a secure conference room with walls of soundproof glass. Gabriel and Ari Shamron were seated along one flank of the table. Adrian Carter was standing at the head of the room, a laser pointer in hand. On the projection screen was an image, captured by an American spy satellite, that provided coverage of Western Russia. It showed a small dacha, located precisely 128 miles northeast of the Kremlin's Trinity Tower. Carter's red dot was focused on a pair of Range Rovers parked outside the house. Two men stood next to them. Our photo analysts believe there are more security guards posted on the backside of the dacha. The red dot moved three times. Here, here, and here. They also say it's clear those Range Rovers are coming and going. 2 days ago, the area received several inches of snowfall, but this image shows fresh tire tracks. When was it taken? Midday. The analysts can see tracks going in both directions. Shift changes? I suppose so. Or reinforcements. What about communications?
Hadache is electrified, but NSA is having trouble locating a landline telephone. We're certain someone in there is using a sat phone. We're also picking up cellular transmissions.
Can they get to them?
They're working on it.
What do you know about the property itself?
It's controlled by a holding company based in Moscow.
Who controls the holding company?
Who do you think?
Ivan Karkov.
But of course, said Carter.
When did he buy the land?
Early 90s, not long after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Why in God's name did Ivan buy a parcel of birch trees and swampland 100 miles outside Moscow?
He was probably able to get it for a couple of kopecks and a song.
He was a rich man by then. Why this place?
CIA and NSA have many capabilities, Gabriel, but reading Ivan's mind isn't one of them.
How big is the property?
Several hundred acres.
What's he doing with it?
Apparently nothing.
Gabriel rose from his seat and walked over to the screen. He stood before it in silence, hand pressed to his chin, head tilted to one side, as if inspecting the canvas. His gaze was focused on a section of the woods about 200 yards from the dacha. Though the woods were covered in snow, the aerial view showed the presence of 3 parallel depressions in the topography, each precisely the same length. They were too uniform to have occurred naturally. Carter anticipated Gabriel's next question.
The analysts haven't been able to figure out what those are. The working assumption is that they were caused by some kind of construction project. I found several more a short distance away.
Is there a photo?
Carter pressed a button on the console. The next photo showed a similar pattern. 3 parallel depressions, overgrown by birch trees.
Gabriel cast a long glance at Shimron and returned to his seat. Carter switched off his laser pointer and laid it on the table.
It's clear from the vehicles and the presence of so many guards that someone important is staying at that dacha. Whether it is Kiara and Grigori.
Carter's voice trailed off.
I suppose the only way to know for certain is to put eyes on the ground. The question is, are you willing to go in there based on the word of a Russian assassin and master kidnapper?
Carter's eyes moved from face to face.
I don't suppose any of you would like to go into a little more detail about how you were able to track down Petrov so quickly.
The question was greeted by a heavy silence. Carter turned to Gabriel.
Should I assume Sarah took part in the commission of a crime of some sort?
Several. Where is she now?
I'm not at liberty to say.
With Petrov, I take it.
Gabriel nodded. I'd like her back. As for Petrov, I'd like him too, when you're finished with him, of course. He might be able to help us close a couple of outstanding cases.
Carter returned to the satellite photo.
It seems to me you have 2 options. Option number 1, go to the Kremlin, give the Russians the evidence of Ivan's involvement, and ask them to intervene.
It was Shimron who answered.
The Russians have made it abundantly clear they have no intention of helping us. Besides, going to the Kremlin is the same as going to Ivan. If we raise this matter with the Russian president,
the Russian president will tell Ivan, Gabriel interjected, and Ivan will respond by killing Grigori and my wife.
Carter nodded in agreement.
I suppose that leaves option 2, going into Russia and bringing them out yourself.
Frankly, the president and I anticipated that would be your choice, and he's prepared to offer a substantial amount of help.
Shimron spoke 2 words. Hachul Valavan. Carter gave a faint smile.
Forgive me, Eri, I speak nearly as many languages as you, but I'm afraid Hebrew isn't one of them.
Hachul Valavan, Gabriel repeated. It means blue and white, the colors of the Israeli flag.
But for dinosaurs like Ari, it means much more.
It means we do things for ourselves, and we don't rely on others to help us with problems of our own making.
But this problem really isn't of your own making. You went after Ivan because we asked you to. The President feels we bear some responsibility for what's happened, and the President believes in taking care of his friends.
What kind of help is the President offering?
For understandable reasons, we won't be able to help you execute the actual rescue. Since the United States and Russia still have several thousand nuclear missiles pointed at each other, it might not be wise for us to be shooting at each other on Russian soil. But we can help in other ways. For starters, we can get you into the country in a way that doesn't land you back in the cellars of Lubyanka.
And?
We can get you out again. Along with the hostages, of course.
How?
Carter dealt an American passport onto the table.
It was burgundy-colored rather than blue, and stamped with the word official. It's one step below a diplomatic passport. You won't have complete immunity, but it will definitely make the Russians think twice before laying a finger on you. Gabriel opened the cover. For now, the information page contained no photograph, only a name, Aaron Davis. What does Mr. Davis do? He works for the White House Office of Presidential Advance. As you probably know, the President will be in Moscow on Thursday and Friday for the emergency G8 summit. Most of the White House Advance team is already on the ground. I've arranged for a late addition to the team. Aaron Davis? Carter nodded. How's he going in?
The car plane.
I beg your pardon. It's the unofficial name of the C-17 Globemaster that brings the presidential limousine. It also carries a large, detailed Secret Service agents. Aaron Davis will board the plane during a refueling stop in Shannon Island. 6 hours after that, he'll land at Sheremetyevo Airport. A U.S. Embassy vehicle will then take him to the Hotel Metropole.
And the escape hatch?
Same route, opposite direction. On Friday evening, after the final session of the summit, the Russian president will be hosting a gala dinner. The president is scheduled to return to Washington at the conclusion, along with the rest of his delegation and the traveling White House press corps. The buses depart the Metropole at 10 p.m. sharp. They'll go straight onto the tarmac at Sheremetyevo and board the planes. We'll have false passports for Kiara and Grigori, just in case. But in reality, the Russians probably won't be checking passports. When will I arrive in Moscow? The car plane is due to land at Sheremetyevo a few minutes after 4 a.m. Thursday. By my calculation, that leaves you 42 hours on the ground in Russia. All you have to do is find some way of getting Kiara and Grigori out of that dacha and back to the Metropole by 10 p.m. Friday, without being arrested or killed by Ivan Zamyatin. I'm afraid I can't help with that. You also have a more immediate problem. Ivan's emissary is expecting a reply to his demands tomorrow afternoon in Paris. Unless you can convince him to push back the deadline by several days... Carter didn't have the nerve to finish the thought. Gabriel did it for him. This entire conversation is academic. I'm afraid that's correct. Gabriel stared at the satellite photo of the dacha in the trees, then at the time zone clocks arrayed along the wall. Then he closed his eyes, and he saw it all. It appeared to him as a cycle of vast paintings, oil on canvas, rendered by the hand of Tintoretto. The paintings lined the nave of a small church in Venice, and were darkened by yellowed varnish. Gabriel, in his thoughts, drifted slowly past them now with Kiara at his side, her breast pressing against his elbow, her long hair brushing the side of his neck. Even with Carter's help, getting her and Grigori out of the dacha alive would be an operational and logistical nightmare. Ivan would be playing on his home turf. All the advantages would be his. Unless Gabriel could somehow turn the tables. By way of deception. Gabriel had to get Ivan to let down his guard. He had to keep Ivan occupied at the time of the raid. And, more pressing, he had to convince Ivan not to kill Kiara and Grigori for another 4 days. In order to do that, he needed one more thing from Adrian Carter. Not one, actually, but two. He blinked away the vision of Venice and gazed once again at the photograph of the dacha in the trees. Yes, he thought again. He needed two more things from Adrian Carter, but they were not Carter's to give. Only a mother could surrender them. And so, with Carter's blessing, he entered an unoccupied office in the far corner of the annex and quietly closed the door. He dialed the isolated compound in the Adirondack Mountains, and he asked Elena Karkov if he could borrow the only two things in the world she had left.